Welcome to the BioCurious podcast with your host, Kayla Osterhoff. As a health scientist, biohacker, and generally curious person, I'm always looking for new ways to optimize and integrate mind, body, and spiritual health. I created this podcast to explore the magic and science of human biology and expand your consciousness through learning. If you enjoy the episode that you're about to hear, please leave a review and share it with someone who can benefit from the information. Now let's get curious.
Welcome back, everyone, to the BioCurious podcast. Today we are talking about eating. Most of us enjoy food and tend to indulge when we most likely shouldn't. This leads to unhealthy habits, and in doing so makes us curious on ways to help combat that. With today's guest being a veteran psychologist who in the past have been a CEO of a consulting firm where the clients were of the food industry, but more specifically in the Fortune 500 category. He has also studied for decades on eating habits and psychology and is now an author of the book Never Binge Again. We like to introduce Dr. Glenn Livingston. Lastly, we at BioCurious Podcast would like to thank today's episode sponsor, Neurohacker Collective. Neurohacker Collective's mission is to create the best-in-class well-being products by employing a unique methodology to research and development based on complex system science. They have several product lines from the cognitive to the sleep and energy line. Use discount code BioCurious at checkout to receive 15% off anything including subscription services. And stay connected with us on our Instagram at BioCurious_podcast.
Dr. Glenn Livingston, thank you so much for joining the BioCurious podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm delighted. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, I am so excited for our conversation because we are going to talk about something that I'm very interested in, and something that actually a lot of my listeners in the BioCurious community, as well as clients, struggle with, which are behaviors around eating and weight loss and how that has to do with psychology. So before we dive into all that juiciness, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this field of work?
I could tell you a lot about my background and how I got into this field of work. So I suppose the most important thing to know about me is that I'm not just a doctor who decided to work with people that struggled with their eating. I'm someone who struggled with eating very much myself for many, many years. If you happen to go by a 7-Eleven in Syosset, New York, and they were out of pizza and Pop-Tarts, there's a good chance that I got there before you. At least it was like that maybe 15 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
I'm 6'4", and I'm modestly muscular. And when I was about 17, I discovered that if I worked out for 2 hours a day, 2-3 hours a day, I could eat whatever I wanted to. So, you know, multiple pizzas, boxes of muffins, boxes of munchkins, chocolate bars, lattes. My binges usually started with chocolate bars, actually, and then progressed to other things. And it wasn't really a problem because I was, at least I didn't think it was a problem, because I was thin and I was modestly handsome, and it wasn't really interfering with my life except that I was having to exercise and sleep and poop a lot. And when I got a little older, unfortunately, when I was 22, 23 years old and I was married and I was commuting 2 hours each way to go to graduate school and I was seeing clients and, you know, when I was helping to run a business and my ex-wife, but wife at the time, wanted me to actually talk to her when I got home, I just didn't have the time to keep working out the way that I was. I could barely work out for an hour a week, much less 2 hours a day. And my metabolism was slowing down. And unfortunately, I still felt like food had a hold of me, like it had a life of its own. And so I kept eating like I was eating, even though I wasn't working out like I was working out, even though I was older. And so I would gain weight and then I would lose it, and I'd gain weight and I'd lose it, and I'd kind of creep up a little bit each time. But the early symptoms that bothered me more were that I wasn't really able to be present with my patients. I come from a family of 17 psychologists. I wanted to be a psychologist my whole life. That was the most important thing in my life, was to be a really good psychologist. And if you know anything about it, you know that it's not really an intellectual endeavor. I mean, it is in the sense that you're solving a jigsaw puzzle of your client's life, but it's not in the sense that they're not going to do anything with the solution unless they feel loved and trusted enough that they're comfortable thinking new thoughts and taking risks and doing new things. So you really have to lend them your soul or it doesn't work. And this is particularly true with people in crisis, like suicidal adolescents and, you know, couples after an affair was discovered. And those are the kinds of people that I was working with. And I just found I couldn't be totally present. I mean, thankfully I never lost anybody. And out of hundreds of couples I work with, only two of them ever got divorced, but that I know of. But, you know, I was far from my best. I was very involved with food, and I'd be, you know, sitting with a suicidal client and wondering when I could go get the next pizza. And that bothered me more than the weight. And being from a family of 17 psychologists, psychotherapists, I thought to myself that this must be a psychological problem. It must be that I've got a hole in my heart, and if I could fill the hole in my heart, I could stop trying to fill the hole in my stomach. And so I really spent 25 or 30 years pursuing that line of thought. I went to the best psychologists around. I was brought up in and around New York City, so it's a very good town for that kind of thing. So I went to the best psychologists around, and I went to a psychiatrist and took medication for a while, and I went to Overeaters Anonymous, and I guess the part of my story that I skipped was that my ex-wife traveled for business. And so we didn't have kids, and I didn't commute. I worked at home. So I had an awful lot of time on my hands, and I wound up having a dual career. And the second career was as a research consultant for large companies. I was kind of on the wrong side of the war. I was helping, you know, big food companies, big pharmaceutical companies, but mostly big food, to, you know, figure out how to sell more sugar, fat, and salt, right? And I wish I didn't do it, but I did, and I know a lot about food because of that. And I decided that since I was getting paid to do these large studies, I should do one for myself. And I put together a study of 40,000 people on the internet. It took a couple of years when clicks were cheap. And it was about the stresses people encountered in their life and the foods that they went to when they felt stressed. And I'll get to the results of that study in a minute or two, but I just want to tell you that the result of the immersion in the corporate food culture, you know, big food, big advertising, the result of really having thought through what I was being told in the 12-step programs, the result of evaluating what the psychiatrists and psychologists were telling me, and, you know, I'm a psychologist myself, so I knew how to evaluate the literature. And the result of studying some neurology, it led me to the conclusion that I couldn't love myself then. That I was going to have to be more like an alpha wolf taking control of a challenger for leadership. It was almost like these drives to, you know, eat 10 chocolate bars were coming from someplace inside me. I now know that it's the reptilian brain. It was coming from the reptilian brain, and it was very much like any other biological drive, like your bladder or your reproductive organs, where at some point you have to take control and say, okay, I know you really have to pee right now, but, you know, I'm in the middle of this interview and I can't do that at the moment. I don't really have to pee, by the way. But if I did, I would take control and I would say, I've got other priorities because I've got a function in, you know, civil society that I'm trying to fulfill right now. And I'll take care of you later. Same thing with your reproductive organs. You have to take control. You can't just run out and kiss attractive women that you see on the street or a bus, right? So
some people might like to.
I kind of wish I could, but I don't.
That's another psychological issue. We won't get into that.
That's another story entirely.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a time and a place and a way to approach people. And
yeah.
That's how that works. And I said to me, three factors which convinced me that I had to change the paradigm, that it was not possible to love myself then, that I couldn't nurture my inner child back to health to fix this, but that instead I needed to be more like the alpha wolf, taking control of a challenger for leadership. And if you think about what the alpha wolf does in a pack, if it's challenged for leadership, it doesn't say, oh my goodness, someone needs a hug. It snarls and it growls and it says, get back in line or I'll kill you, right? It just asserts its superiority and does what it needs to do. Three things that convinced me that my emotions were not causing the binge. They might be related to the binge, that they were not causing it. One was that I saw inside the big food industry that they were spending millions, if not billions of dollars to engineer these hyperpalatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and oil and salt and excitotoxins. And it was all targeted at the bliss point of the reptilian brain without giving us enough nutrition to feel satisfied. And the result is, it's almost like our survival drive is hijacked and pointed towards all these bags and boxes and containers. And every time you're looking for love at the bottom of a bag or a box or container, there's some fat cat in a white suit with a mustache that's laughing all the way to the bank. And I knew from animal studies that it was possible to hijack your survival drive. For example, if you put electrodes in the pleasure center of the brain, they've done this in, I think they've done this in higher mammals all the way up to humans now, but I know they started with rats. You find that, and you connect that electrode to a lever so the rat can self-stimulate, what you'll find is that the rat will push the button thousands of times a day to the exclusion of their survival needs. So a starving rat will ignore its food. A nursing mother rat will ignore her pups. A male rat will climb over painful electrical grids to get to the button and push it thousands of times per day. It's really a hijacking of their survival drive. And I don't think that anyone's putting electrodes in our brains. I don't think they're sneaking into our apartment at night and performing brain surgery on us. I'm not that paranoid. But when you can walk out of a McDonald's in most cities in the country and see a Burger King across the street, when there is some type of fast food available on just about every street corner, I don't think it's a far stretch to say that there are chemical electrodes that we're dealing with and that we've all been given these pleasure buttons that don't really exist in nature. And the result is that people want those things as opposed to, you know, what nature has to offer. I mean, most people will tell you, I know that if I want to lose weight, I have to get myself to really love fruits and vegetables, but I just don't like fruits and vegetables. They don't even taste good to me anymore. That's because of a process called downregulation of the nervous system and the taste buds. When you present a supersized stimulus to the brain or the taste buds repeatedly, like a chocolate bar, for example, that we didn't have any chocolate bars in the savannah. They didn't evolve in nature. It's a concentration of pleasurable substances that you couldn't get up until a couple hundred years ago. So for 99.9% of our evolution, we just didn't experience that concentrated level of pleasure. When you present that kind of supersized stimulus to the brain over and over again, it downregulates its pleasure response to everything else. It's kind of like when I was in graduate school, I slept underneath the subway at an apartment in Astoria, Queens. And the first week I was there, I couldn't sleep at all. After a month, I couldn't even hear the subway because my nervous system had downregulated its response to that supersized noise. Same thing happens with food. Same thing happens with sugar and salt and, you know, fat. And so when you eat a chocolate bar every day, it begins to feel like, you know, there's just no point in having fruit or vegetables. The good news is that you can reverse that. And the research suggests that within just a few weeks, I think it's 6 to 8 weeks, that your taste buds double in sensitivity if you can get rid of a lot of the overstimulation. Maybe not all of it, but a lot of it. Anyway, so I say, well, this is a very powerful external force that has nothing to do with the fact that my mama didn't love me enough when I was a kid or that I was in a bad marriage. There's nothing to do with my emotional conflicts or my loneliness or depression or anything like that. The second thing that convinced me was the advertising industry. And most people think that advertising doesn't affect them, but having been a consultant for many decades in the advertising industry, I can tell you that these companies would not be spending as much money as they spend on advertising if it didn't affect you. As a matter of fact, it affects you more when you think it doesn't affect you because your sales resistance is down. And I remember working with an advertising agency whose responsibility it was to sell nutritional bars, quote unquote nutritional bars. And the VP of that agency, who happened to have been a good friend, pulled me aside and he was leaving the company. And I said, I got to tell you something about those bars. What we figured out to make the company profitable was that we had to remove the vitamins from the bars because it made it taste bad. And it was costing a lot of money. So we removed the vitamins from the bar and we put the money into the packaging instead. And we made it look healthy as opposed to be healthy. So they invested in vibrant multicolored packaging that in nature, vibrant multicolors would signal a diversity of nutrients available, diversity of micronutrients. That's why they tell you to eat the rainbow. When you eat a salad, you want to include some green lettuce and red tomatoes and yellow carrots and, you know, blueberries and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you're eating the rainbow, you're getting a diversity of micronutrients. So they're taking advantage of this evolutionary device inside of us that is attracted to a diversity of color because we will find more micronutrients, but they're faking us out. There's not really micronutrients in there. They're just making it appear like it was. And that was very, very profitable for them. And this kind of thing goes on across the whole industry and you don't even know what's happening. So those are two things that made me realize these are external forces. This is not psychological. The third thing was I did this study with 40,000 people who took a survey and intercepted them while they were searching for solutions to stress on the internet. And I asked them what they were stressed about and I asked them what they couldn't stop eating. And the people who couldn't stop eating when they felt stressed, they were of three different patterns. People who were stressed at work had trouble with pretzels and chips and salty, crunchy things. People who are really stressed at home, they had struggles with starchy, soft, chewy things like pasta and bagels and pizza and things like that. And people who were stressed about their love life or feeling, you know, depressed and lonely, they struggled with chocolate. And that kind of corresponded to what I was going through. And so I'm almost done. I'm sensing you want to move on. I'll let you do that in a second. The real tipping point for me was when I figured that out about chocolate and I called my mom, who is also a psychotherapist. And I said, Mama, I've got this study and you know, I really struggle with chocolate. And that's always the beginning of my binges. You know, first is chocolate bars and then pizzas and lattes and everything. But you know, I really struggle with chocolate. I found out that people who struggle with chocolate tend to be lonely and brokenhearted. And, you know, I'm not in a great marriage and I'm not so happy, but is there some way that this pattern started? You raised me. How did I learn to go to chocolate when I was feeling lonely or depressed or brokenhearted? And my mom gets this horrible look on her face and this horrible sound in her voice. And she says, I'm so sorry, honey. And I said, Mama, what is it? Whatever it is, it's 40 years ago. I forgive you. I'm just trying to figure it out. She said, well, when you were 1 year old in 1965, your dad was a captain in the army and they were talking about sending him to Vietnam. And I was terrified. We were trying to have a second kid and a lot of people were not coming home from Vietnam. And I was just terrified. The same time your grandfather, my dad, he had just gotten out of prison and I had idolized him my whole life and I had no idea he was guilty. And I was just in a depressed and anxious funk. And half the time when you came running to me for food, or quite frankly, just for a hug or some love or some cuddles, I didn't have it to give you. I was sitting and staring at the wall. I was terrified and depressed. And so I kept a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in a refrigerator on the floor. And I would say, honey, go get your Bosco. And you'd go crawling over to the refrigerator and you take out the bottle and you'd suck on the cap and you'd go into a chocolate sugar coma. And if this were a movie, at that point, Mom and I would have a big hug and a big cry and we'd forgive each other and I would never have trouble with chocolate again, right?
I'm assuming that is not what happened.
It's not what happened. It's not what happened, mm-hmm. Kayla. I certainly forgave my mom and forgave myself. It was a helpful conversation to have. I was softer. That self-castigating voice got softer. What happened instead, though, was there was this voice of justification in my head, and it went something like this. You know what, Glenn, you're right. Your mama didn't love you enough when we were kids, and she left a great big chocolate sized hole in your heart. And until you can fix your problems and get out of this marriage and find the love of your life, you're gonna have to go right on binging on chocolate. Yippee, let's go get some right now. So that voice of justification actually used the trauma to make it okay that I was having more chocolate. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I did something rather embarrassing, which I never thought was going to be public. I figured this was going to be very private. And so knowing that the seat of the food addiction was likely the lizard brain, the reptilian brain, the seat of the fast feast and famine response, the seat of fight or flight, the emergencies that take care of our survival when we perceive there to be a threat to our survival. Knowing that that's what was overriding my best judgment all the time, and also knowing that the lizard brain doesn't know love. When the lizard brain looks at something in the environment, it says, do I eat it, do I mate with it, or do I kill it? It's like a bad college drinking game, eat, mate, or kill. Love is in the higher brain. You know, before you eat, mate, or kill this thing, says the neocortex and to some extent the limbic system, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact will that have on the people that you love, on your tribe, on your family, and what impact will it have on your longer term goals and your spirituality and your music and your art and the contributions you're trying to make and the person you're trying to be in the world? Those are all upper brain functions, but food addiction comes from the lower brain, which is overriding all those upper brain functions. So here's what I did. I said to myself, I'm going to call my lizard brain my inner pig. I should have chosen another word. I didn't know that 15 years later I would be out telling everybody about my inner pig, but que sera sera. I would draw a very clear, bright line between healthy and unhealthy food behavior. So for example, I will never eat chocolate on a weekday again. I will only ever have chocolate on a Saturday and Sunday. And I would, at the moment of impulse, when I was, for example, in a Starbucks on a Wednesday, and I heard a little voice saying, you know, Glenn, you worked out hard enough. You're not going to gain any weight. A little's not going to kill you. And besides, chocolate comes from a cocoa bean, and that grows in a plant, and therefore it's a vegetable. I would say that is not me. That's my inner pig. My pig is squealing for pig slop. Chocolate on a Wednesday is pig slop. I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And as ridiculous as that sounds, as crude and primitive as that sounds, it would wake me up at the moment of impulse and give me the opportunity to make a different decision. And slowly but surely, I adjusted the rules and found rules that I could and would follow. And I won't say that it was a miracle. It wasn't like I was instantly better. But over the course of a year or two, I started making the right choices. I what was miraculous was that I no longer felt powerless and confused about what was happening. I saw the separation between my upper brain and my lower brain. I stopped giving in to the case of the efforts that I would get so often. And I adjusted the rules to things that would keep me thoroughly nutrified, so I wasn't in the feast and famine cycle. I was flooding my body with nutrition at a slight caloric deficit, So I would lose the weight that I needed to lose. My top weight, I was probably around 180, 280. I stopped weighing myself around 257, but I got fatter after that. And I hover between like 200 and 210 these days. So, you know, over time, coming up with different types of rules and really understanding how to separate the upper brain from the lower brain and keeping a journal for 8 years, I managed to get thin. More importantly, I managed to garner an understanding of that voice of justification. And now I see the relationship between food addiction and psychology very differently than I used to. Mm. I used to think the food addiction was like a raging fire that you had to put out to fix. You know, it was this real trauma in my heart. Now I think the problem is that it's more like a fire in a fireplace in the living room. And if I've got a really good fireplace, then that fire can rage all it wants to. And as a matter of fact, it becomes an asset, not a liability. It's this voice of justification that pokes holes in the fireplace and lets the ashes come out and burn down the house. And, you know, I spent those 8 years thereafter keeping a journal about all the things my pig would say and why it was wrong, and really defending my fireplace and making it solid. And this was all going to be private until just before I was getting divorced. The CEO in a publishing company that I was a minor part in asked me if I could write a book because they wanted to do some marketing experiments. And I told him about this and he read it. He read my journals and he said, I edited it into a book, a rough book. And he read it and he proceeded to lose 100 pounds. And we published it along the way and it really took off. And so now I'm a doctor who walks around saying, I've got a pig inside me and maybe you do too.
That's my story. This is fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing that story and being vulnerable enough to share your personal experience. However, you know, embarrassing it might be, it is really helpful for folks who are dealing with some of the same stuff, which I would argue is probably everyone if you're eating food in the American diet to some extent. But it's really fascinating that you describe this way, because this is actually what I study in my doctoral program, but through a different lens. So what I was hearing from you is that the process that you came up with, basically what you're doing is you're addressing the subconscious mind, which for you, you called your pig, your inner pig. And your subconscious mind, as you know, as a psychologist, but some of the listeners may not know this, is mostly programmed by the time you're around 7 or 8 years old. So, you know, in vitro through that time period. And that programming in your subconscious is responsible for at least 95% of your behaviors, if you let it. I like to have that caveat. So basically what you're doing is you're not letting that subconscious mind that was programmed when you were a child to determine your behaviors, because you've done the things that I teach as well. So my steps that I talk about that are very well highlighted in the research in talking about the subconscious mind and, for instance, clinical hypnosis and these things are, number one, bringing awareness, self-awareness, right, to that subconscious mind and what it's saying. So I absolutely love that you determined a process for this in naming your subconscious mind something and then recognizing when that subconscious mind is speaking, and also knowing that you have a choice and that is not necessarily you. It's not your conscious mind. It's not your decision-making mind. And you have the ability to override it. So number one, first step is bringing awareness to it, because a lot of people are kind of just going through life completely unaware that this pesky subconscious mind is driving behaviors that they don't want and habits that they don't want. And then the second step is repetition. There are other ways to kind of reprogram that subconscious mind, but awareness basically provides access to it. Then repetition is what enables you to change that programming. So your step two in this was you recognized when the inner pig was speaking, And then through repetition of deciding, I'm not going to act on that talk, was your repetition to starting to reprogram. And I'm sure that now you probably don't have to deal with that inner pig voice much anymore, because after repetition, you can actually reprogram that subconscious mind and create, after time, you can actually create new neural pathways that cause you to choose different or have different behaviors, and it will eventually become less conscious, and the new habits, new behaviors, new decisions will eventually override the old behaviors and become a lot more natural.
You're very well said.
Yeah.
Very well said. I don't disagree with anything you're saying. The benefit, there's a slight twist on it, which is that if you were only to see it as a subconscious mind, there are branches of psychotherapy which suggest you need to integrate and accept that to become a whole person. So, you know, in Gestalt therapy or in Jungian therapy, they talk about, And I'm defining this part of the subconscious mind as the destructive part. This is the part that doesn't care about your higher values and goals and dreams. All it cares about is the instant gratification, and it's almost sociopathic. It would sacrifice the things that are most important to you and the people that are most important to you in a second if it thought it could justify the old behavior. And so I think that calling it my inner pig, some people call it their food monster or their, you know, junkyard dog, or something that you want to disassociate from rather than to reintegrate and reown into your personality. It seems to be important. Yeah.
I 100% agree with you, 110%. I actually hate that old school mentality that comes from old psychology. I'm not poo-pooing all Jungian aspects, but I am poo-pooing that aspect where you must identify, accept, and integrate. I don't agree with that at all. I'm 100% with you. I think that when you're looking at the subconscious mind, there are going to be some programs that do serve you, and those are great. Keep those. But there are absolutely going to be some that are not serving you, that are driving behaviors that you don't want to have. Those you actually, if you want to, you can get rid of those. And I think you should. If you want to make those behavior change and you want it to be sustainable, you absolutely must change those programs. And what you're talking about are programs around addiction and food addiction specifically, and binge eating. And I think that this applies to any behavior that you want to change. If you are addicted to sex, or if you are addicted to relationships that are not serving you, and I use addicted lightly, and I think that all of these things that you do that you don't necessarily want to do, if you have road rage, or if you, have issues with communication, whatever these kind of bad habits are that are not serving you in your life, absolutely identify what the subconscious program is there, that inner voice that's not serving you, that's driving those behaviors, and then work to change it. So 100%, I am totally with you there.
And a big part of the insight was to have a clearly operationalized definition of healthy versus unhealthy behavior. So it's not enough to say, well, I'm going to eat well 90% of the time and, you know, avoid chocolate 10% of the time. Or
right.
The other way. Yeah. You need to say specifically when it's okay and when it's not, so that you can then define that that troublesome voice inside of you, that old pattern voice inside of you, as anything that suggests that you're going to cross that line. The line is what makes it easy to hear the voice.
Yeah, so I love that. So for somebody listening, and maybe it's not chocolate, and maybe it's not even food, but if somebody's dealing with some kind of behavior change that they want to make, what are your steps? Where do they start? What are those definitions that they should set and parameters? And is it okay for them to like have times when they are allowed to engage in that behavior? And how do they set up those boundaries?
Yeah. So I tell people to start with one simple rule. Most people are used to alternating between feasting and famine. Either they're on a diet or they're being horrible, right? It's like that old nursery rhyme, when she was good, she was very, very good, but when she was bad, she was horrid. And as a consequence, not only are they telling their brain that they live in an environment where sometimes food and nutrition are scarce, so that when it is available, they should hoard it. And that's a big part of what we think causes the binge eating cycle. But they also are setting the bar so high that they'll typically fail and then go the other way. And so we like to tell people you got to go to kindergarten before you go to college. So whatever behavior you're trying to change, think of something that would turn the ship around, but it's not too onerous or burdensome. So for example, I knew a truck driver who was eating fast food all day long. And he said, well, I'm not going to stop eating fast food. That's just not possible. But I'll tell you what, I won't go back for seconds. And so his simple rule was, I'll never go back for seconds. And he proceeded to lose 150 pounds starting with that one simple rule. There's another person who said, I don't want to define any food as good or bad, but I just want to define a behavior as mindful or not mindful. And so, well, actually this was a she, and what she did was she said that she's always going to put her fork down between bites. There are rules you can make that do allow for those exceptions. Like some people will say, well, I never eat flour except for twice a week at a restaurant when I can have one flour dish of my choice, like a, you know, pots or pasta or pizza dish, and one serving of dessert of my choice, or one piece of bread. The key is, if you're going to make, we call them conditional rules, where there are some times when you have an exception, you want to define what those exceptions are really clearly and define what the boundaries are of them. It's kind of like if you're shooting at an archery target, you have your bullseye that you shoot at every day, then you have your second and third rungs of the archery target that are a little wider and easier to hit, but you know where they start and stop. And it turns out the benefit of that is that it eliminates decision fatigue. There's a lot of research that suggests, and there's some controversy with this, but it's largely still suggestive, that there are only so many good decisions we can make each day, and that willpower is not really a black and white thing that some people have and some people don't. Rather, it's more like a fatigable muscle or gas in the tank. And the more decisions you have to make throughout the day, the harder it is to make good ones as you get later and later in the day. And this is why so many people binge at night when they're good all day. And what a hard and fast rule does with very clear boundaries is it makes your food decisions for you. If I say, I am going to avoid chocolate 90% of the time and indulge 10% of the time, the problem with that is that every time I'm in Starbucks in front of a chocolate bar, I have to make another decision. Is this part of the 90%? Is this part of the 10%? But if I were to say, I will avoid chocolate 90% of the month and I will only ever eat chocolate on the last 3 days of the calendar month, well, then my chocolate decisions are made the first 27 days of every month. And so if you want to make conditional rules, then just make sure you define where they start and end. And a lot of people, just with that one tip alone, they're able to control themselves when they weren't able to control themselves before.
I love that approach. I think that is incredible, and I think it could really apply to any behavior change that a person is trying to make.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, it can. Yeah, people use this with you know, gambling or productivity, mm-hmm. or, you know, they'll say, I will never look at my email before I've worked on one important project for an hour again, right? So that gives them 1 hour in the morning to work on their most important project for the day before they get distracted by urgent tasks and requests. I mean, any behavior that you can define a very clear black and white line with very clear parameters for, you can use this, and then you define the impulse to stray from the productive behavior as your procrastination pig or your inner sloth if it has to do with exercise, those kind of things.
Yeah, I love that. And for me personally, one that I've recently done, and I actually didn't realize that I was using your technique, so I love that it's kind of tied into this, but I made a rule for myself that I am no longer going to schedule calls, podcast recordings, meeting with clients. Nothing will be scheduled for work before 10 a.m. for me, because from the time I wake up until 10 a.m. is my time to do my morning routine, make sure I start my day off on the right foot, to practice self-care. And it has made such a difference on my nervous system. And it has really kind of perpetuated amazing health benefits across the spectrum of my health, not only productivity, which was the initial intent.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. And the morning is probably your best time, right?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Morning's my best time. And then, you know, I'm a creative as well. So I have this archetype where I do get a burst of energy like at night, and I kind of have to battle that so that I can fall asleep.
I call that idea-based insomnia. When I put my head down on the pillow. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I go into a flow state right before I go to bed, and my mind is going like crazy, and I have the best ideas and, you know, business ideas and inventions and all kinds of crazy things.
Yes, that's right. I keep something to write with by the side of my bed so I can write them down and get back to sleep.
Yeah, I love that. And is that where the idea for your book came?
No. I mean, the idea came from the book really came from my... from the CEO of that publishing company who asked me if we could publish something. Yeah. And, you know, I was getting divorced and I was going to have to close everything else down because there were all kinds of entanglements. And so I needed something to do.
Nice.
And it all just seemed, this was the most meaningful thing I'd ever done. So I said, well, what if I can turn that into a business?
Yeah. So speaking of morning routines, this leads into a question that I like to ask all of my podcast guests. I'm curious, do you have a specific morning routine that sets you up for success for the day? And does it have anything to do with this inner voice and how you kind of interact with it throughout the day?
It does, actually. So I don't have this rule anymore because it just kind of became part of my character, but I installed this routine using a never binge again rule. I would say I will never do anything else besides use the bathroom in the morning before I've made my food for the day. So what that looks like is I get up and sometimes I have to peel and freeze some bananas. Sometimes I'll be making a big salad for later. Sometimes I'll be putting together a soup. And I'll think through what the day looks like for me, what I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat it. And that if I'm going to be going out with friends or colleagues or a business meeting, I'll actually look up the restaurants we're going to be going out to and figure out what I'm going to have ahead of time. That way I don't have to make any serious food decisions as I go through the day. So it settles me down. It lets me know that my food's taken care of. I'm not going to go hungry, and I'm not going to have any surprise moments where I really want to indulge. And then I will journal for about 5 minutes. I'll ask my pig if it has any good reasons that I should break my rules and binge today. I want to see if it has anything it wants to squeal about. And it usually doesn't these days because it's tired of fighting.
Yeah.
Once in a while it does. And then I have to disempower that squeal. So for example, if the pig says you could just start again tomorrow, the truth is that the principles of neuroplasticity say that if I have a craving that I indulge today, it's going to be harder to start tomorrow, not just the same.
Right.
So I'll logically disempower the squeals that it gives me, if it does give me any. I will often follow that with about 10 minutes of writing down or analyzing a dream. I'd studied dream analysis intensively when I was
younger. Love that.
Yeah, and that helps me a lot. I'll ask myself, what's the single biggest win I could get today? If I couldn't do anything else, but I got this done, what would that be? And once I've done all that, then I'll exercise. I live in the ocean, so sometimes I'll walk 4 or 5 miles to the lighthouse and back. Sometimes I'll go to hot yoga. Sometimes I'll just jump on the exercise bike. And then I'll take a shower, jump in the pool, take a shower, and then I'm ready to start the day.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you're set up in a great place, and I'm jealous for your morning routine because it includes the ocean and the beach, which I love. But I really love that you eliminate decision fatigue from your day, because it's such a real thing. When you have too many decisions that you have to make, when you have not set clear boundaries, when you have not set clear parameters around what it is exactly what you want to do and how you want to behave, it's very difficult to actually make a decision because, as you mentioned, willpower is a very limited resource. It only goes so far, and then the rest of it has to be your environment and how you set it up for yourself. So I love that you kind of set your environment. Yeah.
There are studies that show that people have more trouble resisting marshmallows if you make them do math problems beforehand because they had to use too much brain glucose. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's totally true. I don't do well. Like, for instance, when I go to a restaurant and the menu is like 5 pages long, I have such a hard time, and people hate waiting for me to decide what I want because I just can't make a choice. And when the menu has like 3 things, I'm like, oh, thank God, this is so much better.
That's adorable.
So
it makes total
sense. Yeah. So you shared so much valuable information today with us. And so I'm curious, out of everything you've shared, or maybe something completely different, if you could provide just one piece of tangible information to the audience that they could apply to their life to improve their overall health and well-being, what would that be?
Sure. And then I'd love to give your audience a free copy of the book, if that's okay.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We're definitely going to talk about where to find you, what you have going on.
Okay. This piece of advice is based upon the notion that binging might be just a bad habit. You've probably spent a lifetime trying to figure out, is it because your mama didn't love you? Is it because you peeped at your sister when you were 5 years old and you feel guilty about it? You've probably spent a lifetime with all these complicated theories, but what if it was really no more than a really bad habit? And what if you were going about things the wrong way, trying to love yourself thin, trying to follow guidelines as opposed to rules? And, Peter McWilliams said, you can have anything you want, you can't have everything you want. And Jim Rohn said, a life of discipline is better than a life of regret. And what if you chose one simple rule? Like if you, the listener, took a breath right now and just calm down and ask yourself, if I only did one thing, what if I stopped eating at 8 o'clock? What if I only had one handful of nuts every week? What would that one thing be that would make a big difference, but it wouldn't be too onerous and you could do it? And write it down with clarity, and then watch yourself try to break it. Watch this thing inside you try to talk you out of it. When it happens, take a breath, write it down. Writing is an upper brain activity, binging is lower brain activity. Write it down and ask yourself, how in any way is your inner pig, inner food monster lying to you? How is it lying to you? If that's all you do, you'll be well on the way, and you might have more control than you've had in years. You'd be very surprised. So,
I love that. I think that is going to be so helpful to so many people. So thank you so much for sharing that piece of advice. It's helpful for me in the goals that I'm trying to achieve. I love that. So I'm going to start practicing that.
We've worked with thousands of people, and we find that's the best single piece of advice that we we give them.
I love it. Yeah. So tell us about your book. Where can people find it? And what else, what other offerings do you have out there?
Okay. So it all starts at neverbingeagain.com. If you go to neverbingeagain.com and click on the big red button, you'll see the reader bonus list. And if you sign up for that, you'll get a free copy of the book in Kindle, Look, or PDF format, as well as a copy of the Food Plan Starter Templates. We created a set of potential rules. You need to own them for yourself and modify them. We created a set of potential rules for just about every dietary philosophy that there is. So whether you're, you know, high carb or low carb or ketogenic or vegan or point counting or calorie counting, whatever it is that you're doing, we'll show you a set of rules that might be a good starting point. And I know this sounds very harsh in theory in the abstract, like, why does Kayla have this Dr. Ryan who's got a pig inside of him?
No, they won't be surprised if you, they know me well enough. They'll be like, oh, that's yeah, funny. this is right on brand.
So what I did is I recorded a whole bunch of sessions, which are also free, and you can listen to how it's implemented in practice and how it takes people from feeling powerless and confused and hopeless to feeling excited and enthusiastic and optimistic in just one session. So that's what we have for you at neverbingeagain.com. The book itself, it was originally a diary. I edited it into a kind of allegory. So it's not an academic book. It reads really easily. People say that it's funny. I didn't write it to be funny, but apparently there's a great sense of relief when you see all the things that my pig said, because apparently I'm not the only one who has a pig that says those things. And we have a million readers, and maybe you'd like to be another one. So it's at neverbingeagain.com. Click the big red button. And everything I described is free. There is also a paperback and an Audible copy for charge. And then we have coaching programs, which you'll get to if you sign up for the reader bonus list.
Awesome. Well, that's very generous to offer this for free. I think that is such a valuable resource that the listeners, I'm sure, are going to jump on that offer. So thank you so much for providing it to us. And thank you again for just sharing your knowledge and wisdom with the BioCurious community today.
Thank you for having me on, Kayla, anytime.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the BioCurious podcast. If you want to support the show, the best way to do so is to leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you liked this episode and know somebody who could benefit from the information, please take a screenshot of the episode and send it to a friend. You can also post a screenshot of the episode on Instagram or Facebook, and be sure to tag us so that we can repost your post and so we can reach out and thank you for being a listener. Have a great week.